"Morning, gentlemen," he said, walking into his office to find the two men on his office sofa, drinking his coffee. "How can I help you?" "Good morning, Mr. Barrington," one of them said. "We'd like to ask you some questions about a couple of corpses on Park Avenue." Stone refreshed their coffee cups. "Get out your notebooks, gentlemen," he said, "and your recording devices." They did so, and Stone launched into an account of his every moment since meeting Meg Harmon in Key West, covering every detail of his visit to Gino Bellini's apartment and the events taking place there. An hour later, he went to his desk, took out Bellini's pistol, and handed it to one of them. "Do you have any questions?" The two men looked at each other. "I don't believe so," one of them said, tucking away his recording device. "We'll call you if anything comes up." They shook hands with him and left. 5 minutes later, Joan buzzed him.
"Dino on one."
Stone pressed the button.
"What?" "Were you nice to my detectives?"
Dino asked.
"I gave them coffee and bored them rigid for an hour," Stone replied.
"Are you still pissed off about last night?"
"Certainly."
"Did you take it out on Meg?"
"Probably."
"Can I speak to her to ascertain whether she's still alive?"
"If you can find out what hotel she's staying in."
"And how would I do that?"
"Start with the Pierre and work your way down."
"Dinner tonight?"
"Will Viv be there?"
"No, she's still in California."
"Call me when she gets back. I'll need someone to talk with over dinner."
"Have a nice day,"
Dino said, then hung up. 37. Tommy Chang stirred from his sleep, wondering what had awakened him. The doorbell rang a second time. Tommy struggled out of bed and padded to the front door of his small house in his boxer shorts and bare feet. A uniformed messenger of some sort stood there, holding a box. Tommy opened the door.
"You need a signature?"
"Yes, please,"
the man replied, holding out an electronic device with a pen attached. Tommy signed, took the package, and went back inside. He considered diving back into bed for another couple of hours, but a glance at the clock on the wall told him that he had already used up that time. He went into the kitchen, began the coffee by switching on the drip pot, then put an English muffin into the toaster oven and pressed the start button. He looked at the box and could not find a return address. He figured it must be from Dirty Joe, because who else would be sending him things by overnight delivery? He hefted the package, and it felt as if there might be a book inside. He wondered for a moment if he had made anybody mad enough at him to send him a bomb. Decided he had not, then found a box cutter and opened the box. Inside was a shipping envelope, sealed and pre-addressed, plus a business envelope. He opened the business envelope and read the letter inside, which appeared to have been printed from a computer file. It did not begin with a salutation or end with a signature. "I don't know if you read newspapers or watch television news, so I may be the first to tell you that Joe and Jane were killed by the Maine State Police in a gunfight yesterday." Tommy was shaken by that news. They were his friends, and he and Joe were business partners. Yesterday, as mentioned in the letter, would have been the day before yesterday. He took a deep breath and began to read again. "Joe told me a while back that his will is in the safe at your office, and that you and Jane are his heirs. If she is deceased, then everything goes to you." Tommy thought about that. He and Joe were partners in a flying school and air charter service at the Marathon Airport. And they also owned a small marina and boatyard nearby. His next thought was that they were cash poor, and that Joe had told him he was going to New York
to remedy that, which meant to Tommy that Joe had taken a contract on somebody, and that he had probably been killed in an attempt to execute it. He read on. There is $100,000 in $100 bills in the envelope contained in this package. There is also some information regarding the individual who was the subject of Joe's attention at the time of his demise. If you wish to replace Joe in the effort in which he was involved, you may secure the money and get on with it. If you do not wish to accept, you need only return the cash in the envelope provided, and you will hear no more from me. Should you accept the offer, you must complete it within 10 days of receiving this package, or return the money. Details of the subject and of Joe's death are in the package. The subject is in New York City, as I write this, and the last known address is a private townhouse on East 49th Street, owned by a person known as Stone Barrington, a lawyer whose office is on the ground floor. There is a thumb drive in with the cash. Download it to your computer, and it will automatically populate your iPhone. The app keeps constant surveillance at all times and will display the location on a map. I do not wish to hear from you again, and you will not hear from me. I wish you good luck on your assignment and a prosperous year. The letter was not signed, but Tommy knew the sender to be Gino Bellini, with whom he and Joe had shared a cell for a few months in their extreme youth. Tommy had no intention of returning the money. He opened the shipping envelope, which was addressed to a building on Park Avenue, apartment 30, and found, as promised, 10 packets of $100 bills and 2 news stories, one from a newspaper, the other from a business magazine. The first from a Maine newspaper, apparently downloaded from the Internet, described the circumstances of Joe's and Jane's deaths on a boat at an island in Penobscot Bay called Islesboro. The second was an article from a business publication with 2 photographs about a businesswoman named Meg Harmon, who had recently sold a large share of her company and netted something more than $1 billion. He knew that Bellini had made a large sum himself on the transaction. Tommy called his office, and his chief pilot, Raina Cobb, answered.
"Bad news," he said. "Joe and Jane are dead."
There was a brief silence at the other end. Then she said,
"Holy shit."
"Yeah, I know. Day before yesterday. In Maine, I just heard a few minutes ago."
"Are we going to be okay?"
Raina asked. She was aware of their cash flow problem.
"Yeah, we are. I'm going to want you to make a deposit today, tomorrow at the latest. I'll be there in a few minutes. I have to fly to New York for a few days, so have the Baron refueled, and you take the Cessna 210.
"Okay. See you soon."
Tommy hung up, then downloaded the app to his computer and checked his iPhone to be sure it was working properly. A blue dot appeared at New York City. He showered and shaved, packed a bag, dressed, locked up, and headed for the airport. He parked in his usual spot and went into the office. Sheila, his secretary, was at her desk.
"Tomorrow you can start paying bills," he said. "Raina will confirm when the money's in the bank."
He went into Raina's office, opened the shipping envelope, and took $10,000 for expenses, then gave the rest to Raina.
"I can fly this afternoon and be at the bank by noon tomorrow," she said.
The procedure was to fly to Nassau, then depart there on a flight plan to Jamaica, then, an hour out, change the destination to Georgetown in the Cayman Islands.
"Okay. I'll be back in a week or so."
He took his bag into the hangar and stowed it in the baggage compartment of the Beach Baron. Then he went to a steel locker in the hangar and removed an aluminum case on wheels
containing 2 handguns, a folding sniper rifle, and ammunition for all. He stowed that in the Baron, then hooked up the tow to the airplane and pulled it out onto the ramp. He used his cell phone to check the weather, which was good, and file a flight plan for Brandywine Airport in Westchester, Pennsylvania. At the appropriate moment, he would cancel his flight plan and land instead at Essex County Airport in Caldwell, New Jersey, and from there take a car service into New York. Tommy did a thorough pre-flight inspection of the airplane, then started the engines. He entered his flight plan into the Garmin 1000 flight computer, got his IFR clearance from the tower, then taxied to the runway, where he was immediately cleared for takeoff. He lifted off, retracted the landing gear and flaps, switched on the autopilot, and let the Garmin 1000 begin flying the programmed route. Soon he was at cruising altitude, and he set the fuel mixture for best economy. He had a 4-hour flight ahead of him. Plenty of time to make a plan. 38. Stone had lunch at his desk and pretended to work, but he was depressed about how things had gone with both Dino and Meg. His iPhone chimed, and he looked to see who the email was from. There was only one, and he opened it. "Dear Stone, I'm so sorry for how things went last night, and especially this morning. Dino was giving you a hard ride, and I made the mistake of climbing on board. Big mistake. I want you to know how truly grateful I am for the way you have protected me over the past days. I would be dead if you hadn't been there, and I would not have liked that. I enjoy your company so much, not to mention the sex. And I want to go on seeing you. Maybe you'll be able to forgive me after a while, and we can meet for dinner. I'm at the Pierre, in a suite with a nice view of Central Park from a low floor. I'm going to start seeing apartments this morning with your friend Margot Goodale, who sounds very nice and very knowledgeable on the phone. Again, I offer my sincere apologies for my behavior, and I hope you will accept them." Stone read it a second time and melted a little. He wrote back that he would call her soon. A text came from Dino. "Sorry about last night, pal," he said. "Viv's coming in late this afternoon, so you'll have somebody to talk to over dinner. Can we meet at Rotisserie Georgette at 7:30? I'll book. I'm buying to make up for the hard time I gave you yesterday." Stone wrote back, "See you then, and as long as you're buying, I'll pick the wine." Everybody was on time for dinner, and the waiter knew to bring Stone's bourbon and Dino's scotch. Viv had a martini. They clinked glasses.
"I hear you're talking only to me," Viv said.
"It's a relief, really," Stone replied. "Your husband never shuts up, and it's hard to get a word in edgewise."
"Tell me about it," Viv said. "Are you still mad at Meg?"
"No, she wrote me a very nice note today, and I've gotten over it."
"Good," Viv said, "because she's right around the corner at the Pierre, and she's joining us for dinner. And she says she has some very exciting news. Ah, here she comes. What timing."
Stone rose to greet Meg, who kissed him on the lips before she sat down.
"May I have some of that bourbon you drink, please?" she said to Stone.
Stone ordered the Knob Creek, and it arrived quickly. A small jazz group began to play up front.
"All right," Viv said. "What's this exciting news you have?" "I found an apartment," Meg said.
"What, on your first day of looking?"
"First day, first apartment I looked at."
"Tell us about it," Viv said.
"Well, to begin with, it's in your building." "Oh, I know the one. It's 2 floors up from us. The old gentleman who lived there died a couple of weeks ago. His wife died last year."
"Sounds like the one," Meg said.
It wasn't even on the market yet, but Margot got a tip from one of the doormen, and he let us in to see it. It has big rooms and lots of them. The gentleman's kids had cleared it of his personal things, but it's available furnished. Not everything is to my liking, but there are a couple of beautiful Persian carpets that were left, and I'll need some upholstering and a few pieces of furniture. It's even got a grand piano. It will need painting throughout and new window treatments, but it's fit to move into immediately.
Well, Viv said, maybe not immediately exactly. Did Margot explain the application and board approval requirements?
It took us nearly 3 months to get it done.
Margot and I spent the afternoon filling out the documents. My accountant is sending my tax returns, so all I need is some personal references and a meeting with the board.
We'd be delighted to give you a reference, Viv said.
As will I, Stone echoed.
As will Arthur Steele, said Meg, and the board meets next Monday. Margot says that half of the members are on Wall Street, so they'll know who I am, and that will help.
She glanced at Stone. I do need a lawyer to close the sale.
Margot recommended somebody, but I'd rather have you, Stone.
I'll get you the best real estate attorney at Woodman and Weld, and I'll look over everything to be sure it's right.
Margot took a contract over to the seller, who is the owner's son. I made it easy for him by offering the asking price. She expects to get the contract back tomorrow, and if we get board approval, we can probably close by the end of next week.
You're lucky the son didn't want to move in himself, Dino said.
He'd just bought a house in Westchester, and the place is too big for a pied-à-terre.
They ordered dinner, and the women took the opportunity to go to the ladies.
I've got some news, too, Dino said.
Shoot.
We braced Stanislav Beria this afternoon, and as expected, he clammed up and claimed diplomatic immunity.
But
we nailed the gorilla off the reservation, and we have him locked up. Turns out he works for Selwyn Owaki, not for the mission, so he has no immunity. He's being pumped right now for information on his boss. With a murder charge hanging over him, we might be able to turn him.
That is very good news.
His name is Boris Ivanov, and he's a nasty piece of work. XGRU, military intelligence. But forget about the intelligence part. He's just muscle.
I'd be delighted to testify against him, Stone said.
Funny thing, Dino said.
What's that?
He had a notebook in his pocket with your car's tag number written in it.
Damn it. He must have made my car when we were following the mission, Mercedes.
That is not good news, Dino said. If Ivanov has your license plate number, then Beria has it, too. And if he has it, Owaki has it. And by this time, he will have a lot more information about you. Frankly, I wouldn't want Owaki to know that much about me, and since you're the only witness against his guy, you're going to have to watch your ass, at least until we can turn him.
Well, Stone said, hurry the hell up, will you?
The women returned, and they had dinner. Meg looked at Stone closely. Are you worried about something?
No, nothing at all, Stone said.
39. Tommy Chang landed the Beach Baron at Essex County Airport as darkness was coming on. He arranged for hangar space and called a car service to drive him into New York. The car arrived very quickly. His luggage was loaded, and they started into the city. Tommy got out his iPhone and tapped on the locator app. The blue dot appeared on Fifth Avenue at the corner of East 61st Street. This was a surprise, as he was expecting her to be on East 49th Street.
Driver, what's your name?
Jane, sir.
Jane, what's at the corner of Fifth Avenue and East 61st Street?
The Pierre Hotel, Jane replied.
You want to go there?
Let me make a call.
He called American Express Travel and asked them to book him into the Pierre. In moments he had an affirmative reply.
Okay, Tommy said. Take me to the Pierre.
Right.
At the Pierre, Tommy got out of the car and asked Jean for his card.
Jean, are you going to be available for the next few days?
Sure, you can call me directly on the cell number.
Tommy paid and tipped him generously, then followed the bellman with his luggage to the front desk and checked in. The desk clerk's nameplate read Gloria.
Gloria, I'm meeting a friend here. Her name is Meg Harmon. Has she checked in yet?
Gloria checked her computer.
Yes, she has, but she's just left to go out to dinner. I saw her go out.
I guess I didn't get here soon enough,
Tommy said.
What's her room number? I'll give her a call later.
I'm afraid our security precautions prevent me from giving you her room number, Mr. Edwards, she said. He had checked in and presented a Texas driver's license and a credit card in that name.
I'll just leave her a note, then. May I have paper and an envelope?
She handed it to him. He wrote a note saying,
Carl, I'm in town. Call me on my cell.
He tucked it into the envelope, sealed it, and handed it back to Gloria. Then he completed the registration form.
How many keys, sir? Gloria asked.
Two, please.
She gave them to him in a small packet, and he turned to follow the bellman to his room. As he did, he saw Gloria put the envelope into a box with the number 212.
You're on the third floor,
the bellman said as they boarded the elevator,
with a view of the park.
Perfect,
Tommy replied. The room was large, with a king-sized bed and a comfortable seating area. He asked the bellman for some ice, then he went to the window and looked out at the park.
I'll bet you have the same view, he said.
The bellman returned.
Tell me, Frank, he said, reading the man's name tag. I like to go for a run in the morning, and I noticed a stairway across the hall. Can I go down and come back that way instead of taking the elevator?
Yes, sir. Just use your key card, Frank replied.
Tommy overtipped him, and he left. Tommy gave him a head start, then left the room, went down the stairs, and let himself out of the stairwell with his key card on the second floor. Room 212 was just across the hall. He examined the door and its lock carefully, just like his own rooms. He walked down to the ground floor, found the bar, and ordered a drink and some dinner. He finished dinner a little after 10, charged his food and drink to his room, and left. With any luck, the shift would have changed at the front desk. He was right. Tommy approached the front desk and took his spare key card from its packet and handed it to a young man on duty there.
My name is Harmon. I'm in room 212, and my key card isn't working. Can you give me a new one, please?
The young man checked his computer for the name.
It says here, Meg, he said. Michael Edward George Harmon, Tommy said. Meg, for short.
I see.
He put a new card into a slot and tapped in a code and the room number.
There you are, Mr. Harmon, he said,
handing Tommy a new packet. He thanked the young man, then went to his room. He opened his weapons case, chose a small 9mm pistol, and screwed a silencer into the barrel. Then he stretched out on the bed for a moment. He would wait until the middle of the night to visit Miss Harmon. He dozed. Tommy woke up with sunlight streaming into his room. He checked the bedside clock. 7:20 a.m. Shit, he said. He had been more tired after the long flight than he had thought. He ordered some breakfast from room service,
then shaved and showered. There was a New York Times slid under his door, and he put on a robe and read it until breakfast came. When he was done, he dressed in a business suit, went downstairs and crossed the street, carrying the arts section of the Times. He took up a position on a bench along the wall that separated Fifth Avenue from Central Park, and had a good look at the hotel. Room 212, he calculated, was to the left of the front door and one floor up. He took a small monocular from a pocket, concealed it in his fist, and pointed it at the windows. The curtains were still drawn. She must be sleeping late. He folded the paper open to the crossword puzzle, took out his pen, and began. 20 minutes later, he was halfway through the puzzle, and the curtains were open in room 212. He took the folded page from the business magazine containing the article on Meg Harmon and studied the face in the two photographs, committing it to memory. She was a very good-looking woman, he thought. He began the puzzle again, checking a clue, then checking the hotel's front door, then writing in the answer, and checking the door again. More than an hour passed in this fashion. Then finally the hotel door opened, and a well-dressed blonde walked outside and was immediately shown into a waiting town car, which drove away. He couldn't find a cab quickly enough to follow her, but at least she was out of her room. He went back into the hotel and went up to his room. He opened the weapons case and took out some miniature electronics equipment. Then he left his room, went into the stairwell, and went down to the second floor, opening the door with his 212 keycard. A maid's cart was a few doors down the hall, and a card saying, "Please make up my room," was hanging on the doorknob of 212. He used his new keycard to let himself inside, turning the door card over to read, "Privacy, please." It was a large, handsome suite, sitting room and bedroom. He went to work installing a tiny camera and a microphone in each room. He wished he'd had a third camera. It would have been nice to install it in the bathroom, so he could see her naked. Well, time enough for that, he thought. He opened the front door a crack, checked for the maid, who was closer now. He turned the card on the door handle over again, then closed the door and took the stairway down to the street. Might as well do some shopping, he thought. He'd check on Miss Harmon around 6, when she might be changing to go out. 40. Stone was in his office the following day when Joan buzzed him.
"Miss Harmon on 1, she said.
He picked up the phone. "Good morning."
"Good morning. I enjoyed myself last evening."
"So did I."
"If you're free this evening, come and have dinner with me at the pier."
"Love to."
"Come to my room, 212, and we'll have a drink there."
"All right. See you then." They both hung up.
Tommy Chang slept late, then checked his cameras in 212 with his iPhone. The rooms were empty, and there was a room service table there, bearing dirty dishes. She had gone out. He checked the locator app. The blue dot was a dozen blocks downtown and moving. He'd have to make tonight the night. Stone's next call was from Dino.
"Good morning," he said.
"Good morning," Stone replied.
"I've got some more news, and it isn't good."
"Break it to me."
"Remember Boris Ivanov?"
"The gorilla? How could I forget him?"
"He's out."
"What?"
"He's lawyered up. A senior partner at Craig and Zanoff showed up and sprung him."
"That's a white shoe firm," Stone said. "What's the lawyer's name?"
"Greg Zanoff."
"The guy with his name on the door comes down and springs a Russian gorilla? That doesn't make any sense."
"I guess Selwyn Iwaki can buy anybody he likes."
"I don't know much about Iwaki,
just what I've read in the papers.
Owaki specializes in not having anybody know anything about him, Dino said. He does his deals at arm's length, always has a lawyer or two between him and his customers. He has 8 or 10 houses in world capitals, lives like a potentate, makes large donations to charities. He's handsome and charming.
I've never even seen a photograph of him.
We have one in our files, but it's of very poor quality, Dino said. I couldn't make him on the street.
Do I have anything to worry about?
You're the only witness who can put Ivanov in Bellini's apartment at the time of the murder.
But not enough of a witness to convict him?
I would have thought so, but Ivanov is on the street now and probably has left the country. Owaki has a fleet of private jets, 3 or 4, plus a couple of helicopters. In New York, he works out of the 4 top stories of a very expensive apartment building that he owns on East 57th Street.
Sorry, he owns the apartment or the building?
The building and the apartment.
That's a new one on me, Stone said.
Listen, if you've got an army you want equipped, Owaki is your guy. Weapons, aircraft, missiles, tanks, you name it, he can assemble and deliver the order.
Anything else?
Yeah. During the short time he was talking, Ivanov told us his excuse for being in Bellini's apartment.
Which was?
A computer thumb drive that contains the plans for something that his pal Beria had bought from Bellini.
I know about the thumb drive, Stone said.
You don't have the thing, do you?
No, I gave it to Meg. The designs belong to her company, and Bellini rigged his computer so that Beria could open the files once, but the second time the data would be destroyed.
So Meg has what Beria, which means Owaki, wants.
Yes, she does.
Does Beria know that?
No, but he may think I have it. Bellini could have told him.
Listen, pal, I think you better go armed for a while, and I mean day and night.
But you think Ivanov has left the country?
I think maybe he has, but Beria hasn't. And he could walk into your office, blow your brains out, and we couldn't touch him.
Well, he did get a look at me in that elevator. And he saw me get into my car.
And he saw you following him, too, and he got your tag number, remember?
I remember.
Maybe you should go to England or to Paris, Stone. I mean, you have those houses, so pick one and get out of town.
I already got out of town once, and it didn't do a lot for me.
Then call Mike Freeman at Strategic Services and get him to put some people on you for a while.
I'll think about it, Stone said.
Listen, I've got another call to take, so I've got to run. I'll call you later.
See ya, Stone said, then hung up.
41 Stone took a cab uptown and presented himself at room 212 at the Pierre. Meg answered the door, put her arms around his waist, pressed herself against him, and consented to be kissed.
"How are you?" she asked finally.
"Better than I was before I rang the bell," Stone replied.
Tommy Chang had just turned on his computer and the cameras when he saw a man led into the room. Miss Harmon greeted him very, very warmly. Then she led him to the living room sofa, and he sat.
"Knob Creek, I presume,"
Meg said. "And I had better presume correctly or call room service."
"That will be just fine," Stone said, and she poured one for him, then a vodka for herself.
She sat beside him on the sofa, and they drank. Tommy figured they would be having their drink, then going out. He fiddled with the sound and finally could overhear their conversation.
I've missed you,
Meg said. I've missed you, too, and it's only been 24 hours.
I have an overwhelming desire to fuck you,
Meg said. But I've ordered dinner for us here, and I don't want to be interrupted by a room service waiter.
Whoa, Tommy said to himself. This could get good.
Meg unzipped Stone's trousers, freed him, and buried her face in his lap. Tommy felt that she was doing it to him. He couldn't believe his luck. Stone laid his head back and enjoyed himself while Meg continued. Shortly he climaxed and she relented. She tucked him back into his trousers and zipped him up.
There, she said.
There indeed, Stone replied. Now, what can I do for you?
Well, since I came at the same time you did, just talk to me.
After dinner we'll consider our options. Stone took a deep breath and tried to restore his heartbeat to its pre-fellatio condition. A large swig of bourbon helped. They finished their drinks, and she poured them both another. The doorbell rang, and she called out, "Come in!" Tommy calmed himself. A waiter had appeared, pushing a cart, and he set it up by the windows. After that terrific first act, he was going to have to watch them eat dinner. He hadn't expected a caller. He hadn't expected the sex. And he hadn't expected them to remain in the suite for dinner. The waiter served their first course of seared foie gras and said that he would return to serve their second course.
"How was your day?" Stone asked.
"Very good. Margot Goodale and I completed all the co-op forms, and my accountant faxed me 3 years of tax returns and my financial statement. And you, Dino, and Arthur sent over your letters of recommendation. I have to pay to have their detective service do a background check on me, which is supposed to be happening tomorrow."
"That means a man will sit down at a computer and do a search for a criminal record, both federal and state. Have you committed any felonies or misdemeanors?"
"None."
"Any DUIs?"
"None."
"Any lawsuits against you active?"
"None."
"Then he will so notify your board and collect his outrageous fee." It certainly was outrageous for so little effort. Well, he had to pay for his computer and the software. Everybody has to make a living.
Sometimes I have to think that everybody has to make a living off me.
It's what happens when you become suddenly wealthy in public. Everybody in the United States who reads the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or any other newspaper subscribing to the Associated Press Wire Service now knows your approximate net worth. And a significant number of them are trying to figure out how to separate you from a portion of it by selling you some product or service. Another, hopefully smaller, number are trying to figure a way to swindle you out of some of it.
Tommy was getting bored. He considered going down there, letting himself into the room, and shooting both of them at the table. But then the waiter returned, removed some of their dishes, and set new ones before them. Also, it would be unprofessional to make that sort of mess. He'd rather the bodies were discovered the following morning, when the maid entered to clean the suite. "I've had 15 or 20 emails trying to sell me a private jet," Meg said.
"That's something you should consider," Stone replied. "You've already seen, flying with me, how convenient it is to have your own airplane at your disposal."
"I have indeed," she said. "What would your recommendation be?"
"Your first consideration should be how far you are likely to fly and how often. Will your work take you, say, to Europe or the Far East, or will you most often just fly between San Francisco and New York?"
"I don't anticipate flying to the Far East, but I would like to travel in Europe."
"Well, a citation latitude will get you to London or Paris from New York, or to Hawaii from San Francisco."
"And how much does it cost?"
Between 15 and 20 million, I should think, depending on the equipment you choose.
Tommy was considering shooting them again, but the waiter kept coming and going, and shooting him, too, seemed excessive. After all, he was being paid to shoot only one person. The waiter took the tray table away and put the Do Not Disturb sign on the door. Meg took Stone by the hand and led him into the bedroom, where she proceeded to undress him. Tommy had been prepared to go downstairs as soon as the waiter was out of the picture, but now they were in the bedroom, and he thought he might as well watch the sex. As she undressed him, he caught sight of a shoulder-holstered pistol. He wasn't going into that room if the guy was armed. Soon they were both naked, and Meg led him to the bed and climbed on top of him.
"Now," she said, "let's consider our options."
Tommy sighed and settled down to watch the sex. He was not disappointed with what he saw.
"If you like, I can recommend a consultant who will, for a fee, help you choose what you need in terms of speed, range, and accommodations."
42. Tommy woke up a little after 7 a.m. The camera was still on in the bedroom, and Harmon and Barrington were just waking up, too. In a moment, they were at it again. Tommy watched the performance and was again impressed. Then they phoned down for breakfast and did it again while they waited for room service. Tommy shaved, showered, and dressed and checked the camera again. They were finishing breakfast and talking about getting up. The man went to take a shower, and Miss Harmon lay naked on the bed. Tommy heard the newspapers slide under the door, and he picked up the Daily News. There was a picture of a girl in a bikini, but a headline caught his eye. "Suspect in Bellini murder is released."
Bellini? Who Bellini?
Tommy turned to the designated inside page and read the brief story. The chief suspect in the murders of Gino and Veronica Bellini was released from jail yesterday after a judge ruled that there was insufficient evidence to hold him. It is feared that Boris Ivanov, a Russian in the employ of that country's UN mission, may have fled the country. Tommy stopped reading.
"Fucking Gino is dead?" he asked himself.
He read the remainder of the short piece.
Fucking Gino was indeed dead.
He put down the paper and thought about things. Gino must have sent him the package shortly before he cashed in his chips. Tommy was working for a dead guy. He considered the ethics of his situation. First of all, the guy in Miss Harmon's suite was probably Stone Barrington, the man at whose house she had been staying. Tommy knew nothing about him, had nothing against him, and was not being paid to kill him. Also, with two murders being investigated, his chances of being caught increased. Second, if he didn't kill the woman, there would be no investigation at all. He could just go home, forget the whole thing, and spend the money. Fuck Gino. Maybe he would come back to haunt him, but he doubted it. Then Tommy heard Barrington's voice.
"What's that?" he asked.
Tommy looked at his iPhone. Barrington was pointing at Tommy via the living room camera.
"I don't know," Harmon replied. "Smoke detector?" "That's not a smoke detector," Barrington said, "and it's not a CO2 detector either."
He left the living room, and Tommy switched cameras. Barrington was looking up and pointing again.
"There's another one," he said. "It's a camera."
"Oh, my God," Harmon said. "Somebody has been watching us?"
"No doubt about it," Barrington said. He got out his phone and called a number.
"Bob, it's Stone. How quickly can you get over to the Pierre?"
"Good. I'll be in room 212. Bring your tool kit. I'll explain when you get here. He hung up.
Well, Harmon said, that was quite an exhibition we gave for whoever was watching. Is this going to end up on the Internet?
I doubt it, Barrington replied. Then he looked up at the camera and spoke to it. Because then I'd have to find whoever did this and kill the son of a bitch.
Tommy's phone rang, and he answered it.
Hello?
Hey, it's Sheila.
Did you get to the bank yesterday?
I did. Everything is just fine. The bills are paid, and so am I. There's other good news, too. A guy just walked in and wants to get his multi-engine rating, but you've got the twin.
He's hot to trot, and we might be able to sell him an airplane, too. When are you coming home?
I'm leaving the hotel shortly, Tommy said. Put him off until 9 a.m. tomorrow.
I think he'll buy that, and even with the 90 grand I deposited, we could use the money.
See you this afternoon.
He hung up and called Jean, his driver. Jean said he'd be out front in 15 minutes. Tommy finished packing. He didn't bother calling for a bellman, since he just had his one bag and the weapons case. He gave some more thought to killing them both, but then he unscrewed the silencer from the pistol and packed them both in the weapons case. That settled his ethics problem. He didn't have time to kill either of them. He left the room with his luggage, went to the elevator, and pressed the button. The car arrived, and he pressed the lobby button. The door opened, and another man started to get into the car, but backed up to let Tommy out. He was carrying a good-sized toolbox.
"I'll bet your name is Bob," Tommy said to himself.
He walked toward the front door, and the man got into the elevator. Jean was waiting at the curb. Tommy gave him his luggage and got into the car.
"A successful trip?"
Jean asked as he pulled away from the curb.
"Well, I made some money," Tommy replied.
"That's always a good idea," Jean said.
Stone answered the door and let in Bob Cantor, who was his genius tech guy.
"Good morning, Bob."
"Morning, Stone."
Stone introduced Meg, who was sitting on the sofa.
"What have we got?"
Bob asked. Stone pointed up at the molding.
"That's not a smoke detector, is it?"
"Nope,
and it's not a CO2 detector, either. It's a camera, and a good one."
"We've got another one in here," Stone said, leading him into the bedroom.
Bob looked up at the camera.
"You sure have."
He looked at the thoroughly unmade bed.
"Were you here all night?"
"Yes," Stone said.
"Did you turn off the lights?"
"Not until we were ready to go to sleep."
"And I guess that wasn't right away."
"Good guess. Can you yank those things out?"
Bob dragged a chair over from the dressing table, stood on it, and pulled the camera off the wall.
"I've used these things myself, although this is a newer model. Beautiful color and high definition. You can see every pore."
"I was afraid you were going to say something like that," Stone said.
Bob hopped down.
"The other one, too?"
"Yes, but just a minute. I've got a question."
"I bet I know what it is," Bob said. "Can I trace the camera to somebody?"
"That's the question," Stone said. "The answer is no. However, as I was getting on the elevator, a guy was getting off, and two things about him struck me."
"What was that?"
"I thought it was funny that, in a classy hotel like this, he was carrying his own luggage. Unusual."
"What else?" Stone asked.
"In addition to a regular suitcase, he was towing a pretty big aluminum case, the kind that might contain guns, or tools, or both. And he was in a hurry. Went right out to where a car was waiting for him."
"Did he introduce himself?"
"Unfortunately, no." "I was afraid of that."
"Give me a description."
"About 5'10", 170. And he looked Asian, coal black hair and slightly slanted eyes, maybe half Asian. Very fit-looking, too, martial arts type."
"That's all you got?"
No, I gotta look at the luggage tag on the aluminum case. Joe Cross, Islamorada, Florida.
You have just identified a dead person, Stone said.
How do you know that? Bob asked.
Because I saw him shot dead in Maine a few days ago.
Well, Bob said, I guess somebody stole his toolkit.
They went back into the living room.
Let me guess, Meg said. You can't tell who put the cameras in, and you can't trace them.
Not exactly, Stone said.
What does that mean?
It means that, with a little luck, we might find the son of a bitch.
Well, that's good news, Meg said.
Sort of.
What do we do with him, then?
I haven't gotten that far yet, Stone replied.
Meg, I think we should move you back into my house.
I'll start packing, she replied.
Bob, Stone said, have you got a plastic bag? Might be worth trying to get some prints off those cameras.
Sure thing, Bob said, opening his toolbox. I can do that for you, and since I know what my prints look like, there won't be any mix-ups.
43. Stone called Fred, who collected them and Meg's luggage, and drove them home. All the way home, Stone thought about the cameras and the man who had installed them. Fred took Meg's luggage upstairs to her dressing room. Stone buzzed Joan.
Good morning, she said. Sleep well?
What do you mean by that? Stone asked.
A simple inquiry into your health and well-being, she said.
Thank you. You remember that time we used that private dick in Key West for that thing?
Sure.
Have you got his name and number?
I'll need 10 seconds,
Joan replied, then put him on hold and came back.
Not Key West. Sugarloaf Key, she said.
Well, that's close enough.
His name is Paul Topino. Shall I get him for you?
Please, Stone said.
He waited until she buzzed him.
Paul on line one.
Paul? Stone?
How are you?
Just great. How about you?
Not bad. I need to find a guy in the Keys, maybe Islamorada.
I do that sort of thing. What's his name?
I don't know, but he has a friend in Islamorada.
Okay. What's his friend's name?
Joe Cross.
Dirty Joe? What do you want with him?
Just his friend.
That's just as well, because Dirty Joe bought the farm up in Maine a few days ago. It made the Key West citizen.
Yeah, I was there at the time.
Really? Did you shoot Dirty Joe?
No, but I was standing next to the guy who did. I'll tell you about it when I see you.
But what about his friend?
The one whose name you don't know?
That one.
You got a description?
5'10", 170, black hair, fit-looking, might be Eurasian.
Tommy Chang.
That'll be $1,500.
You know the guy?
Sure, he's Dirty Joe's business partner.
Doing what?
The two of them own a little charter flight business and flying school at Marathon Airport. They've got a Baron and two or three Cessnas. Tommy does some avionics work, too, installing radios and GPSs and the like. Tell me something. When Dirty Joe got shot by your friend, was he trying to shoot your friend?
No, he was trying to shoot a different friend, or at least his girlfriend was.
Jungle Jane? No shit.
None at all.
There have been rumors around the Keys for years that Dirty Joe and Tommy were doing hits on the side. They were living too well for their business to support their lifestyle. And it doesn't surprise me much that Jungle Jane was helping out. They both got killed, didn't they?
With a single bullet.
By accident?
No, on purpose.
Jesus, nice shot.
Yes, it was.
So you want me to do something to Tommy Chang?
No, I didn't know you did contract work, Paul.
I don't,
but I can get him arrested for you if you've got a charge that'll stick. I'm not going to try and beat him up, either, because he's a martial arts nut. I saw him kick a guy's ass in a bar one time who was twice his size and mean as a snake. Did Tommy do something to you?
To a client of mine, Stone half lied.
Down here or up there?
Up here, last night.
Well, the guy's got that baron. I guess he can go wherever the work is.
I guess so.
What do you want me to do?
I haven't got a charge that will stick, Stone said, so nothing for the time being. I'll get back to you when I know more, and I'll send you a check.
Just joking about the 1500. I wouldn't charge an old client for top-of-the-head info. Buy me a steak the next time you're in town.
I'll do that, Stone said. See you around. They both hung up. Stone called Dino.
Machete.
Dino, can you run a name for me? Criminal record wanted list?
What's the name?
Tommy Chang. Residence, Florida Keys. Probably Isla Morada.
Hang on,
Dino said, and Stone could hear computer keys.
Here we go. Juvie record in California, 2 arrests out there for burglary, charges dropped, another for assault, no weapon, then nothing.
Nothing in Florida?
Nope. He must have kept his nose clean after he moved.
Is it a crime to put cameras and microphones in a hotel room in New York?
Whose room?
Meg's at the Pierre.
That's what she gets for moving out on you.
She's back now.
Well, it's breaking and entering, if he got into her room. Also, if he made a recording of what he saw, without her permission, of course.
He didn't have that.
What did this character see in her room?
Meg.
Naked?
Yes.
Were you present at the time?
Yes.
Naked?
Well, yes.
We could pick him up, but he would probably plead down to a misdemeanor and get a suspended sentence. If he was trying to sell tapes, then it would be a bigger deal.
I've no evidence of that so far.
Is he in New York?
Probably back in Florida.
Well, the DA isn't going to extradite him for that, again, unless he's selling tapes.
I'll let you know.
Sure. If he is selling tapes, I'd like to buy one.
Oh, fuck off. Stone hung up.
44. Stanislav Beria appeared at Selwyn Owaki's apartment building at noon, the appointed hour. He identified himself to a receptionist with his diplomatic passport, then submitted to a stroll through a metal detector and a body search so thorough that he was uncomfortable with it. His laptop computer was thoroughly checked. Then he was allowed to board an elevator that swept him at high speed to the top floor, where he submitted to another search, and was admitted to the enormous living room of Selwyn Owaki's multi-story penthouse. A man in a white jacket settled him on a sofa and brought him a small bottle of San Pellegrino mineral water and a saucer containing half a dozen canapes. He had finished them all before Owaki finally made his appearance, walking down a curved staircase while his eyes swept the cavernous room. He was a tall, thickly built man of indeterminate national origin, wearing what Beria was certain was a $25,000 suit. Beria stood to greet him.
Selwyn, how are you?
Owaki motioned for him to sit down, and he did.
I thought I would ask you that, he said in mid-Atlantic English. Do we have the material?
Beria tapped the computer.
Right here.
Owaki picked up a telephone and murmured something. Shortly a young man appeared.
Give him your laptop, Owaki said, and the file name.
Beria did so, and the young man took the computer to a table, opened it, and switched it on.
I understand you found it necessary to rid yourself of the source and his wife.
Regrettably so. He was the only person who could connect us to the theft of the software.